mother of the Buddhas of three sons, which is unutterable, incomprehensible, inexpressible, unborn, unceasing, the nature of space and the object of the self-cognizant primordial wisdom. Thus I have heard one time the Blessed One was dwelling in Rajagriha on Master Vulture's mountain together with a great assembly of monks and great assembly of bodhisattvas. At the time, the Blessed One was absorbed in the concentration of countless spectral phenomena called profound illumination. At that time also, the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, was looking perfectly at the practice of profound perfection of his, looking perfectly at the emptiness of inherent existence, also of the five aggregates. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said to the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, how should a son of the lineage train who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of his? Thus he spoke, and the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, replied to the Venerable Shariputra as follows. Shariputra, whatever son or daughter of the lineage wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom should look perfectly like this, subsequently looking perfectly and correctly at the emptiness of inherent existence, also of the five aggregates. Form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form also is not other than emptiness. Likewise, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, like this, all phenomena are merely empty, having no characteristics, they are not produced and do not cease. They have no defilement and no separation from defilement. They have no decrease and no increase. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no tactile object, no phenomenon. There is no eye element and so forth up to no mind element, and also up to no element of mental consciousness. And no exhaustion of ignorance, and so forth up to no aging and death, and no exhaustion of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path, no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, because there is no attachment, bodhisattvas rely on and abide in the perfection of wisdom. Their minds have no obscuration, no fear. Passing utterly beyond poverty, they attain the final nirvana. Also, all the Buddhas who reside perfectly in the Tritha, having relied upon the perfection of wisdom, became manifest and complete Buddhas in the state of unsurpassed, perfect, and complete enlightenment. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the equal to the unequaled mantra, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, since it's not false, should be known as the truth. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed. Tatiyata, umgate gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisattva. Shariputra, bodhisattva, a great being, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like this. Then the Blessed One arose from that concentration and said to the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, that he had spoken well. Good, good, O son of the lineage. It is like that. Since it is like that, just as you have revealed, in that way the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced, and that other Gathas will also rejoice. When the Blessed One had said this, the Venerable Shariputra, the superior Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, and that entire circle of disciples, as well as the worldly beings God, humans, demigods, and spirits were delighted and highly praised what had been spoken by the Blessed One. Tatiyata om gate gate parakate parasam gate bodhisattva. Tatiyata om gate gate parakate parasam gate bodhisattva. Gate gate parakate parasam gate bodhisattva. Namo Guru Buddha Dharma Sangha and the Great Mother Vajnaparamita. Through the power and strength of making prostrations to you all, may these true words of ours be achieved. just as before, when by contemplating the profound meaning of the perfection of it and reciting its words, Indra overcame all the harms of Maharas, non-humans, and so forth. In the same way, by our contemplating the profound meaning of perfection of it and reciting its words, may all the harms towards our spiritual practices, such as Maharas, non-humans, be overcome. May they become non-existent. May they be perfect. May they be totally pacified. May I beseech you to totally pacify all the outer and inner obstacles of harms for the achievement of perfect enlightenment. May all kinds of interferences, diseases, and possessing spirits be pacified. May we be separated from unfavorable conditions, and may we achieve favorable conditions in everything excellent. Through this fortune, may there be at this time happiness, and I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment is attained. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment is attained. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Sangha until enlightenment is attained. May I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings by means of gathering merit, such as by performing generosity. May all sentient beings possess happiness and the cause of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all sentient beings not be parted from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings dwell in equanimity, which is free from attachment and anger toward both near ones and distant ones. There are no other great monks even in heaven like you, the great man leader. Not in this world, not even in the place of Vishvaravana, not in the finest places of heavenly palace, and not even in the four directions and the four intermediate directions. How could there be, even if you search everywhere on this surface, including mountains and forests? Salutations to Maitreya, the Dharma regents who dwell in Dushita, whose fire of great compassion haunts the hero, which is light ray of transcendental wisdom, removes the darkness of ignorance and liberates sentient beings from samsara. I respectfully pay homage to the Guru and protector, Reverend Manjugosha. Your intelligence shines forth like the sun, unclouded by the two obscurations. You hold a spiritual text at your heart, symbolic of the seeing of all things as they are. Those who are caught in the prison of samsara are confused in the darkness of ignorance and are overwhelmed by their suffering. You speak with the 60 melodious ways. You preach the sentient beings to whom you are compassionate as to your only child. Your proclamation of Dharma is like a roaring thunder that awakens beings from the stupor of delusions and frees them from the iron chains of their palm. You wield the sword of wisdom, heaving down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of ignorance. Primordially pure, your princely body is the embodiment of the perfection of Buddhism, dwelling on the tenth Bhumin. I pay homage to Manjugosha, who dispels ignorance and whose body is adorned with 112 adornment marks of Buddha. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind, enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into the words of the Buddha and the texts that explain them. Homage to Nagarjuna, who bestowed us 100 rivers of multitude treatises, who manifested 1,000 waves of the collection of Madhyamaka texts, who is beautiful with thousands of precious scarlet. Homage to Guru Shantideva, who had meditated in Nalanda, composed treatises, and gone to the sky. You who have white eyes, knowing all objects of knowledge, you who possess compassion for all beings to achieve wholesomeness and good, you who possess the power of performing inconceivable activities, I respectfully prostrate to you, the Guru Manjugosha. Having smeared the ground with scented water and scattered flowers on it, this Mount Samaru adorned with four continents, sun and moon. By offering it to the Buddha field, may all sentient beings enjoy the perfectly pure Buddha land. May you turn the wheel of Dharma that is common to both Hinayana and Mahayana, according to the minds of sentient beings and different capacity of their intellect. In the section of the manner of engaging into the selflessness, in accordance with the higher Buddhist approach, Mahayana approach, there are two kinds of selflessness. As a very beginners, the followers or the practitioners, who have entered into the path, the liberating path, the first two paths, the path of accumulation and the path of joining, in accordance with the Prajnaparamitayana system, there's no alternative way other than familiarizing or habituating ourselves in the emptiness step by step. The first step to meditate in the emptiness is to habituate ourselves in the non-truly existent. Selflessness of person means non-truly existent of the person. And selflessness of phenomena refers also to, at that very level, it refers to the non-truly existence of the phenomena. Among the two kinds of selflessness, as shown here in this chapter as well, before undertaking the meditation on emptiness or the selflessness, emptiness or dividing, classifying that emptiness into two kinds, selflessness of person or selflessness of phenomena. The practitioner really need a theoretical understanding, especially the convinced, what's a theoretical understanding, gained from reflecting on the presentations, reflecting on the presentations or dialogues given in this chapter, as well as the dialogues
between the realist, dialogue between the mathematica and the realist with regard to the non-truly existent or the emptiness. As I have been emphasizing, in accordance with the teaching, in accordance with the authentic teacher, in accordance with the authentic and teaching, in accordance with the Jinan and pith instructions given by the attempts, the earlier attempts. Unless the practitioner who seriously or who strongly sort of have a wish to undertake the meditation on emptiness, it is not possible without that convinced theoretical understanding. The outer sort of posture, and the outer sort of the manner of doing the meditation, including just blocking the concepts with incomplete understanding or mistaken understanding, or out of inferior sort of intention or motivation, how long we may spend our time, our sort of life in that meditation, it will really not become beneficial. That meditation will not become a beneficial. In another word, that meditation will not sort of become an antidote to lessen our disturbing emotion, especially the very root of disturbing emotion, the concept that conceives the appearances as a truly existent. That kind of meditation does not harm that concept, which is the root of all our disturbing emotions. All our conceptual thoughts, conceptual mental state, including the disturbing emotions. So, by these reasons, keeping these reasons as asserted in the authentic and in Mahayana scriptures, authentic pith instructions on the practice of emptiness, we really should put effort as a first step, means before doing the actual meditation on emptiness or the meditation on selflessness, any kinds of selflessness, any two kinds of selflessness, we really need to build up the understanding within ourselves. So as a method to build up that understanding in a proper way, especially the practitioners with the sharper intellectual state, because of the incomplete understanding of what we have heard about the emptiness, incomplete understanding of the selflessness, many doubts and many misunderstandings, including many doubts, may arise in us. In order to dispel these sort of misunderstandings, including the doubts in the selflessness and the emptiness. The dialogues or the debates during which the author gave many kinds of reasonings, valid reasonings, to prove the Madhyamika's stance, the stance of non-truly existent at the ultimate level of all phenomena, including the person as well, including the object of our concept of I, including the direct object, the person or the I, person or the I. So in the earlier sections, the author was refuting the assertion of the heretics, who sort of heretics who claim that there is a person or the I. Truly existing, any person or I, the object of our egoism. Now, from this on, he is, I think, giving an answer or clarifications, or he is clearing away the objections made by the heretic school concerning the identityless or lessness or selflessness. If there were no permanent self, as Madhyamika school has claimed or advocated or interpreted or pointed out, the topic of their discussion is the direct object of our egoism, concept of I. We human beings, ordinary beings have that concept, egoism, I and mine. Naturally, we have that egoism. The object of that egoism, I or the person, they had a big difference in pointing out or different in defining that I or that person. There have been a big sort of arguments or big sort of debates among the schools. We need to know that sort of point first in order to be able to understand the different interpretation, in order to be able to understand the different reasonings, and then we will understand whose reasoning is valid, whose reasonings are valid, or whose reasonings are invalid. In another word, whose sort of reasonings accord with the actual relative fact, accord with the fact. Whose reasonings accord with the facts, whose reasonings do not accord with the fact. That is important. Otherwise, and if we follow just the word and then try to understand the explicit meaning, not thinking, not sort of reflecting on the implicit meaning as well, then our wisdom may become corrupt, or our wisdom may become opposing factor of the genuine wisdom. Sharapchalwa means, Sharapchalwa is an immoral wisdom. In Tibetan we call the immoral wisdom. There is danger of falling our understanding into that immoral wisdom, or the corrupt understanding. Even though we ourselves may sort of consider that understanding as a valid, or that understanding as a perfect understanding, whereas in the fact, the actuality, it may it may fall in that misunderstanding. So not just reading sort of one time or two times or just going through roughly as you go through the novels. The novels, the topic is not so deep. It's not, they may know sort of implicit, sort of what say, implicit, only the explicit, very clear what say, the explicit sort of meaning. We may go through and then you may think that, oh, I understand. Oh, it's fine, it's like that. Then you remain in that sort of state. That will not bring up the very proper or perfect understanding in oneself. I had a long sort of experience of my life doing that way for almost 20, 25 years. If there were not permanent self, the relation between the action and its effect or its outcome, the action, between action, especially action here referred to the wholesome action and unwholesome action, among the three actions, neutral actions, do not sort of produce a ripening. It may produce some sort of results, but it doesn't. It's the neutral actions with regard in accordance with the Buddhism. They do not produce the ripened what's the result? Ripened result. The state of higher being and the state of lower beings, these two are known as the ripened result. They may be a result concordant with its cause. For example, sleeping, neutral sleeping, the earlier what's the action of neutral sleeping becomes a cause to what's it produce the latter part or stage of sleeping actions, which can be regarded as a result concordant with the cause. So here, the action refers to the two kinds of actions: wholesome actions and unwholesome actions. And their effects refers to there are many results, but the higher state of being, the higher state of being and the lower state of being, these two are the two different and ripened results of the wholesome action and unwholesome action respectively. The doer of action coming to experience the result of actions committed. For example, I think it would not be feasible the agent to experience the result of actions committed by themselves, by him or by her or by them, the agents. This is so because the agent, doer or agent, would perish, means would cease. For example, when someone in this 6 hours before the breakfast, we performed the short ritual. We were the agent. We all were the agent to do different kinds of wholesome actions during those half an hour. So now, the agent ceased already. The agent performing the ritual already ceased. Not only the ritual themselves, but also the agent who was performing, who had who the actions who had who were performing the region during the half an hour that also perished or that also ceased. So he would make that the agent would perish, not as soon as in the Tibetan there's not that word. Action, the agent would perish after the action was committed, and he would not exist at the time of experiencing the effects or the outcome of the actions committed. Even we sort of consider this between the next life and the present life, or between the present sort of action and the result of these actions coming in the future after 10 years or after 15 years or after 20 years. In this life as well, the outcome or the effects of our actions may sort of result within this life as well. Therefore, whose action would that be? Whose actions would that be to experience? So this is objection and made or forwarded by the heretic school. Now, as a clarification or clearing away that objection, the basis for the causal action done in this life, or action done now, comparing between the next life, during which we may experience or we may undergo the result of the present actions, or after 20 years or 15 years, we may face the result or the outcome of the actions performed or committed right now. So the basis for the causal action, the aggregates of this life, or aggregates of the present, aggregates of today. Likewise, aggregates of life, this life, we can also say aggregates of today, aggregates of tomorrow, aggregates of yesterday, and so on. The aggregates of this life and the basis for the ripened effect or ripened result. Ripened result, for example, our human state of being now is a basis of ripened effect in comparison with the past, let's say, the aggregates of the past life. Similarly, the today's aggregates, and at the very moment we are performing a wholesome action, so the aggregates of today or very moment is the basis of the causal action, and this action may sort of produce a result in the future, in this life. Future in the future means in this life, the remaining parts of our present life, or it may sort of produce a result in the next life, in the very next life, or after two lives or three lives or five lives or after 10 lives. We don't know when our actions may produce the result. We don't know. It depends on the unique characteristic of the actions we perform, unique characteristic of the action we perform. The aggregates of the future life are distinct states of being, and since in both these states it is established for both of us, not both for you, both in the latter part, it's better for both of us, you colon or semicolon, you who accept the permanent self, and we who accept identitylessness or selflessness, that the self neither commits the action nor experiences the effect. It is not meaningless. Is it not meaningless to argue on this point? Now, another objection from the heretics: what about actions whose fruit will be experienced in this life? They do not have different basis aggregates upon which the causal action is committed and the result is experienced. Again, they regard, we can see from that, their understanding, their sort of an intellect does not accord the fact, because in the actual fact, our aggregates, even we regard from our natural sort of understanding, we regard our present sort of aggregates as a one. In actuality, they are not one, because the aggregates ceases momentarily, moment by moment, and the present aggregate, the very present aggregates, is not identical or is not the same to the aggregates of the tomorrow or this afternoon or this evening or evening. So in the actuality, their nature is like that. Their relative nature is impermanent, ceasing momentarily, or they cease moment by moment. They are not one. They seem to be one because of the continuum. Because of their continuum, they seem to be one to our, the normal sort of concept, as well as to the heretic. They sort of regard the present aggregates and the aggregates of the 9 o'clock or afternoon or evening, afternoon or tea time or dinner time or sleeping time or bedtime or whatever. So out of their very rough sort of understandings of the relative state of being of our present aggregate, they put forward this objection to the Mathematica's sort of assertion, Mathematica's approach of the identitylessness. The answer or the clarification in this regard as well, with regard to the present aggregates of the present life, it is impossible to see the aggregates of someone committing a causal action being subject to the experience of its results at the same moment, just as a father and his son cannot be born at the same time. In another word, the present aggregates on which we perform the present sort of present kind of present wholesome action of teaching, wholesome action of learning or listening the teaching. So the result of this may produce in this life, but the result which may arise on the aggregates on which we perform the present action. So from the example as well, just as the father and his son cannot be born at the same time, so cannot be born at the same time. Yeah, to, referring to the separate, what you call, like my father and myself, between my father and myself. Again, another sort of objection from the heretic. However, it says in the however, it says in one scripture, this objection not from the heretic, because they don't believe in the Buddha's what say teaching. So that this objection, we need to sort of and bring up all kinds of sort of kalavare, all kinds of all kinds of sort of ideas which may seem to be sort of contradictory to the main what's the approach, main approach, the main sort of assertion, main approach or the main assertion, the selflessness. However, it says in one scripture, how will someone else experience the result of the actions one commits? O monks, the actions you commit and accumulate will not ripen on such things as the external earth element, but upon your future aggregates associated or grasped by consciousness, or associated with the consciousness. Thus, does not your assertion contradict this statement that the doer of the action must experience its result himself? So when we think of the meaning of this statement, and roughly, it may seem to us that even from the viewpoint of Buddhism, the future sort of aggregates on which the result sort of ripens, and the present aggregates on which we sort of perform the actions are sort of identical, are same, as claimed by the heretics. It may seem when we think roughly on that. Now, the answer to dispel such doubts, such sort of any misunderstanding of the statement of the sutra, this statement is to be interpreted. This means that this statement cannot be understood explicitly. We need to understand the meaning of this or the significance of this statement with some sort of interpretation. So this statement is to interpret it as follows. While actually considering the same continuity of individual, the Buddha taught, considering or keeping in mind or keeping in thought the same continuum of the present aggregates on which we perform the action, and the aggregates on which the result of the actions and it ripens, result of the actions ripens. The Buddha taught the doer of the action is the experiencer of the result. In order to prevent people denying the law of karma, law of karmic cause and effect. Actually, this is not so. In actuality, means not at the ultimate level, it means that in the relative fact, there is not so, means the present aggregates and the future aggregates are not identical or not the same. The present self, or we can say like that, present self and the future self are not identical, are not the same. Actually, this is not so, because a permanent self does not exist. From the viewpoint of, not only from the viewpoint of, what say, not only from the viewpoint of ultimate analysis, but also from the viewpoint of relative analysis, self does not exist inherently, or self does not exist as a identical, the present self and the future self. These self do not exist as a identical at the relative level as well. Why is there no permanent self? A question by, why is there no permanent self? As we normally perceive, we conceive the self as a permanent. Yesterday's self, today, yesterday's Jamyang Tenzin, this morning's Jamyang Tenzin, and this afternoon's Jamyang Tenzin, this evening's, and tomorrow's or next year's Jamyang Tenzin, 2 years ago, the Jamyang Tenzin is the same. We regard in that way. So since we normally regard or conceive in that way, so why is there no permanent? Which we normally regard, consider in that way. Whereas from the viewpoint of any Karsagore Mathemika school, from the viewpoint of discerning any discerning state, mental state, or intellectual, more discerning any intellectual state, the Mathemika, they claim that there is no self. We can accept a mere self from the viewpoint of the concept of I, from the viewpoint of unexamining any conventional mental state, the concept of I, we can accept the relative existence of the mere self. We can accept that. But we cannot accept that self and the future self as identical. Not at the ultimate level, but also as the relative level. Because from our conventional sort of viewpoint, we regard, oh, I die, and then I born. That means that from the viewpoint of conventional mental state, we conceive the self as impermanent, the agent as impermanent, the agent as impermanent. We conceive the agent as impermanent. We do not conceive the agent as impermanent. I die, I born. I die, and then I born. We conceive in that way, the agent or the mere self as impermanent. So why is there no permanent self as advocated or as found by the heretics, by their analysis, by their understanding? The heretics found the permanent self. Neither the mind of the past nor the mind of the future are the self, because they are non-existent. The past and the future mind are non-existent at the present moment. By contrast with the present, to the present moment, the past mind and the future mind are non-existent, because the past mind has ceased, and the future mind has not yet been arisen, so they are non-existent. So because of the non-existence of them, they cannot be referred as an itself. Yet, isn't the mind of present moment, the very present mind, which has been produced but has not yet ceased, the self? In another word, they think that can't we sort of consider the present moment as a self because of not having yet ceased. That also from the very rough understanding, not knowing the relative nature, the shortest momentary of the mind, the present mind. Answer: If this were the case, then in the next moment, if the present mind were the self, the permanent self, then in the next moment, when it had ceased, it would no longer be the self. With this reasoning, all five aggregates are negated as being the self. With the same sort of reasonings, not only the mind, the Madhyamika negates not only the mind as a permanent self, as claimed or advocated by the heretics, but also all other aggregates, the form aggregates and the feeling aggregates and so on. We can apply the same reasoning to disprove all other aggregates as the self. That is from the viewpoint of the ultimate analysis. For example, when the trunk of a plantain tree is split into parts, there's no essence found at all. Likewise, when analytically searched for with reasoning means ultimate, with the ultimate reasoning. Means ultimate reasoning means reasoning that reasoning, logical reasoning that scrutinizes the ultimate state of being of the self or any phenomena. That is known as the when analytically searched for with reasoning. We can analytically search the relative state of being through the reasonings as well. Here it must refer to that analytically search for. When analytically search for with ultimate reasoning, or with the reasoning scrutinizes the ultimate state of being of the self, then self cannot be found, the object of I, our concept of I or our egoism, that or the direct object of our egoism, the self or the person, cannot be found at the ultimate level, means from the view from that perspective, or from the perspective of that mental state, that kind of higher mental state. If there were no sentient beings, ultimately, or from the ultimate viewpoint, if there were no sentient beings towards whom all compassions, the practitioner, any practitioner should sort of develop, towards whom. Although sentient beings do not exist ultimately, means from the viewpoint of ultimate analysis, there's no existence of sentient beings. There's no sentient beings, let alone the existence, non-existence, both and non-both, the features of the four possible features of the sentient beings or the phenomena. At the relative level, deceptively, or from the viewpoint of the deluded mind, our normal sort of mental state, mental consciousness, which is sort of polluted or which is stained or which is rooted or which is influenced or affected, I think, which is affected by our ignorant, our true grasping, our concept of conceiving something as truly existence. From the viewpoint of that, at the relative level, one should develop compassion for those imputed as sentient beings, not for those truly existent sentient beings, for those imputed as sentient beings. Imputed as sentient beings imputed by the ignorance, confused mind or ignorance. On whose behalf, I think this is better here, I sort of, from my understanding, one should develop compassion for those imputed as sentient beings by confused mind or by the ignorance, on whose behalf one practice or we practice, on whose behalf one practices the Bodhisattva's way of life, in order to lead them to the goal of liberations. So this talks about three, among the three kinds of compassion, this talks about the first two kinds of compassion. Compassion observing the sentient beings, and compassion observing or focus on the phenomena, not the compassion, non-apprehensible compassion. Is that right? Compassion without fixture, focus. Without object. Mikpa maybe ninja, yeah? Compassion without object. So the third compassion that associates with the transcendental wisdom. Transcendental wisdom in the meditative equipoise. Meditative equipoise. So here it refers to the two kinds of compassion which can be sort of which can be generated as well as sort of enhanced, or which can be sort of habituated in during the off sessions. Yet, if sentient beings do not exist, who will obtain the result of developing compassion? We may have this kind of doubts or this kind of caution to ourselves, not knowing the unique characteristic of the two truths. While engaging ourselves in the practice, we may have this kind of doubt. This kind of doubt may arise in us as well when we do not know the correct understanding of the non-truly existence of sentient beings at the ultimate level, and the mere existence of sentient beings at the relative level. Not only that, also not knowing accurately the non-truly existence of the compassion at the ultimate level from the viewpoint of ultimate analysis, and the mere existence of the compassion and from the perspective of the conventional mental state, not knowing the difference between these. Sort of these two truths, or these two kinds of real nature or reality, we may also have this kind of doubts. So, in order to clear away or overcome such doubts in us while undertaking the practices, we need to build up our sort of proper understanding of the true truths. Occasionally or again and again, we need to stabilize our understanding of the unique characteristic of the true truths. Although ultimately it is true, means ultimately or from the perspective of ultimate analysis, or from the viewpoint of the transcendental wisdom in the meditative equipoise, although ultimately it is true, means there's no sentient beings do not exist. There's no sentient beings. From the viewpoint of that mind, from the viewpoint of those higher state of mind, there's no appearance, there's no any kalavare, there's no appearance of sentient beings. Let alone the caution of existence or non-existence, and so on. It is true that there are no sentient beings, not truly existent. This is sometimes confusing. Ultimately, it is true that there are no truly existent sentient beings. It may show that there are sentient beings. There are mere sentient beings at the ultimate level. Implicitly, this statement, this sentence may implicitly show that at the ultimate level there is an existence of mere sentient beings. This is not the right case. Whereas in accordance with the Gelugpa, they say ultimately there are no truly existent sentient beings. But there is a sentient beings, the existence of sentient beings at the relative level. Many Gelugpas who follow the Tsongkhapa's exposition on the ultimate truth. Some like Jamyang Shepa, I think this is from a Gomang University, on whose collection of works the Gomang schools and he. They emphasize their teaching curriculum, on whose collection of their teaching sort of the teaching curriculum emphasizes. In his sort of view, it is similar with the Sakyabas, Korambas, what say, the presentation, Korambas, any exposition or like that. So they do not say, they say that there are no truly existent sentient beings. They have to add that truly existence. From the viewpoint of Sakyapa, we say there are no truly existent sentient beings, as well as there are no existence of sentient beings. There's no sentient beings at the ultimate reality. Not only the truly existent, but also there are no sentient beings, all this duality, the dual phenomena, or the dualities, all the relative or deceptive truth, all kinds of deceptive truth are do not sort of exist ultimately, means from the viewpoint of ultimate analysis and from the viewpoint of transcendental wisdom in meditative equipoise, not only the truly existent, but also these phenomena. But also these phenomena do not exist. In another word, they do not have the appearances of all these, even the mere sort of sentient beings, mere sentient beings, mere compassion, mere anikara. They do not have the appearance of that. Not very easy. Emptiness, truly existence, this is the most profound topic, most profound sort of the content of the Buddha's teaching. It seemed to be, I once explained to you some days ago, it seemed to be quite easy. If you think of the non-truly existent, then it is quite easy. Quite easy. When we think of the meaning of the emptiness as inexpressibility, then it is really, really very, really very profound, really very difficult. Because that inexpressibility is beyond beyond our concept or beyond our thought. It is not the object of our thought. It is beyond the object of thought. It is beyond the expression, oral expression. So it is not easy. Anyhow, there are many interpretations, even among the Tibetan schools, who all regard their schools as the Prasangika Madhyamika school. There are several interpretations, three main interpretations as Anidhirva, as what's clarified in the moon rays of Koramba, as clarified in the moon rays of Koramba. When you study that, read that, and then reflect on the different interpretations, applying those interpretations with the actual sort of the relative state or the ultimate state of being of the dual appearances, then we will definitely reach in the perfect or the correct understanding of it. Although these are sentient beings, compassion and results, there are no sentient beings, compassion and result. We can say like that, not adding the truly existence. Ultimately, it is true that there are no sentient beings, no compassion, no results. Yet, at the relative level, from the viewpoint of deluded mind confused about phenomena, from the viewpoint of deluded mind, our normal mental state, which is regarded as a deluded mind, which is the basis out of which all the dual appearances or the duality comes. We accept the existence of many apparent results arising. We accept that the existence of merely apparent result arises from mere compassion. Mere apparent compassion. Developed towards merely apparent sentient beings. So in order not to misunderstand the non-existence of sentient beings, when we have a misunderstanding of non-existence of sentient beings at the ultimate reality, then our practice of compassion, when we have a wrong sort of understanding of that, a wrong understanding of the non-existence of sentient beings at the ultimate level, then we, because of the corrupt sort of wisdom, then our practice on compassion may be affected by that. We may not generate good compassion to the sentient beings. We may not feel generating genuine compassion towards sentient beings, viewing the sentient being as non-true at the ultimate level wrongly, viewing wrongly the non-existence of the sentient beings at the ultimate level. There's a really danger of ruining all our method parts of practices. When someone has a wrong sort of understanding of the emptiness. Shazang in Mula Madhya Magakarika, I think in Nagarjuna, he said, If someone views wrongly the emptiness, then those with the lesser intelligence may be destroyed. Yeah. Again, an objection. Since compassion is also a subjective state to which things appear in a false way, especially the first and second compassion, when we generate compassion towards very poor people, beggars, or a very ill person with physical hardship, someone like lying beside the road or lying beside the road, when we generate at that moment, we need to compare or apply this sort of kasura explanation, this sort of exposition with the actual kalavara, actuality, the actual fact we face during our day-to-day life. So since compassion is also a subjective state to which things appear in a false way, so that compassion focus, seeing by our eye the poor sort of any physical sort of state or poor economic state of the people lying on the road, then the mind, the compassion arises. At that very moment, that compassion has the object, the poor sort of any people. That compassion takes that poor people as the object of it, and then generate. May he be free from that difficulties. That is the feeling. That is what is the compassion. Such feeling with such mood. Feeling with such mood is known as compassion. May he be free from suffering. Or when we see some bad sort of man, when he's a butcher or any kalaure, some kind of bad man who involves himself in many kinds of kalavarta, many kinds of illegal actions, such as sort of killing or any causing problems to others. Or when we see him, instead of generating sort of upset or any kalavarta, uneasiness, instead of generating uneasiness, we as a bodhisattva, as a Buddhist, as a spiritual person, we are what's recommended by our teacher to generate a compassion towards him. Compassion. That compassion, so when we generate a compassion towards the very healthy and a very strong, very outwardly very strong, very healthy, and economically very independent or whatever, but seeing his bad sort of actions and thinking of the result of that actions, then we generate compassion towards him, may he be free from that kind of unwholesome actions. So there can be two kinds of the compassion. Two sort of kinds of compassion can arise in us. So on those occasions when we generate compassion, those compassions have the other persons as an object. So compassion is known as a subjective state, to which things appear in a false way, means those compassions have the two kinds of any person as an object, two kinds of person as an object. So those two persons are deceptive truth. That is why it is known here as things appear in a false way. Deceptive truth. The deceptive truth as an object, direct object of that compassion. So, and mind are confused about phenomena. Also that compassion is a mental state which is confused of the phenomena, which does not any sort of focus on the, which just see or we just any, we just focus on the relative whatsoever. We just focus on the relative aspect of the phenomena, relative aspect of the person, those two persons, not sort of realizing or not focusing the ultimate reality of the object. That is why that compassionate mental state is known as mind confused about phenomena. Surely it is equally fit to be rejected or overcome or get rid of. Surely it is equally fit to be get rid of, as is confusion about the self, means as we need to sort of get rid of or we need to overcome the concept of I or egoism. This is the objection. Now answer or clearing away that sort of objection. Since the compassion, that kind of, the first two kinds of compassion, since the compassion is a method of pacifying suffering, is a tool of pacifying suffering, one need not overcome it, and one cannot overcome compassion, because the compassion is the means to instill or to reach in the depth of our to reach in the depth means to reach the ultimate reality of ourself. We need the method part of practices. Without the method part of practices, there's no sort of any way to reach the depth of ourself. The depth of ourself means the ultimate reality of ourself. Ultimate reality of our mind, which is the basis of all our other sort of dual appearances. When we know the ultimate reality of ourself through the help of method, part of practices, then we will definitely know the ultimate reality of all other phenomena. All other phenomena. I think in one of the dirva asanga no thome mare who Aryadevas, one of the Aryadevas texts, he said, one who realizes one entity, one who realizes the ultimate kangyung chik tishin yi thongwa, one who realizes one entity as the suchness or the ultimate reality of one entity, he was realizes the suchness of all the entities. So as I explained earlier, so that is why we need to look inside while doing the meditation. We first need to build up the one-pointedness of our mind, and then look inside the depth of our mind. Look inside the very depth, the ultimate reality of our mind. And when we realize that, then, because it is the basis of all the other appearances of ourself, then we will know the samsaric appearances or the future sort of enlightenment sort of appearances or the appearances on the path or appearances of the basis, the cyclic existence or the all kinds of different sort of appearances or actual sort of any of all the past and then the future, the enlightenment. The mind is the very basis of all these any appearances. So that is why the reason why during the practice we focus inwardly towards our own mind is because of that. Therefore, one should not reject or overcome the mere resultant perception, like compassion. When compassion arises in you, when the loving kindness arises in us, when faith arises in a manifested form and lasts for some minutes, we must not try to get rid of them, thinking that they are also deluded state, or they are also deluded state. Thinking that they are also in a deluded state. So that is not the right way of undertaking the practice, he means. However, the confusion about the self or concept of I must be overcome or must be rejected, because it increases such things as self-importance, because it is the root of the pride, arrogance, jealousy, and so on, feeling of competitions, and so on, which are the causes of the sufferings, causes can be secondary condition of suffering of others as well. Causes of suffering of oneself, and which can become the secondary condition of the suffering of others as well. Objection. If you presume that there are no means to overcome this confusion answer, they are, because meditation upon emptiness or selflessness is the supreme remedy. Supreme remedy means this indirectly or implicitly shows that the morality, keeping one's morality purely, and then the generating sort of faith, maintaining the faith, and then maintaining also the compassion, loving kindness, and then the principally the maintaining one's morality of abstaining from the unwholesome actions. So these also become the remedy. These also are remedy. These are, what do you say? These are also sort of remedy. But the actual and the supreme remedy to overcome the concept of I is the meditation on the emptiness or understanding of the selflessness. Now the manner of engaging in the identitylessness of phenomena. We finished the manner of engaging in the selflessness of person. Now the manner of this presentation on this is given through the exposition on the four kinds of any close placement of mindfulness, intensively placed mindfulness. This is really difficult. This is important actually, because in accordance with the Hinayana and Mahayana both, the beginners, the meditation on emptiness must be either any of these four. Although the Hinayana school and the Mahayana school have a different sort of interpretation in pointing out their mode of perceiving as well as any their sort of the border on which these practices are sort of emphasized, mainly sort of emphasized. So in the sage's intent to Kimbabi Rinpoche's teaching, the English version, I think I kasora translated into strongly placed mindfulness. Tempa nyawara shagba. Tempa nyawara shagba means tempa is mindfulness or awareness. Awareness of now the ultimate reality. Instead of because we do not have this understanding of the kasure, the selflessness of our body or selflessness of our feeling, because of not having the selflessness of our mind, mental consciousness, selflessness of other phenomena, because of not having that understanding, because of having sort of strong habituation in conceiving all these body, feeling, mind, and other phenomena of our aggregates as truly existent, because of following unknowingly the concept of conceiving them as a truly existence, because of that. We cannot build up the proper sort of understanding of the selflessness. Now, in order to have a big change in us, in order to have a big change in our mind, change in perceiving something, in conceiving something, we need to train in this kind of practices. We need to train in this kind of in order to lessen the strength of our concept of grasping something as truly existent, concepts of grasping our body as truly existent, our finger as truly existent finger, without knowing that finger is just an imputation on the parts of the finger. If you find out where the finger is, whether the assembly of this, or whether the outer skin, or upper part, or middle part, or inner part, or in the bones, or then there is many flesh, nerves, and so many. If you really examine very carefully and have a convinced understanding of the selflessness of finger, non-truly existence of the finger, then our way of seeing the finger, when we see the finger, our way of conceiving the finger would totally change. Unless we build up that understanding, unless we sort of keep in mind, we be mindful of that, and then follow without sort of some kind of heedfulness, follow without the mindfulness, without introspection, follow concept of conceiving them as a truly existent, then there will be no progress. There will be no inner sort of kind of progress, not only in understanding, but also in the meditation on this selflessness. This is not easy. Tempa nyawara shagwa, strongly placing the mindfulness, strongly nyawara shagwa. Actually, tempa nyawara jogwa, placing. It's in the present form, then strongly placing, strongly having placed the mindfulness. That means that during that meditation, we need to sort of place our mindfulness very intensively, in a very intensive state. So in order to be mindful of what? Mindful of the non-truly existence of the phenomena, the body, feeling, mind, and the other phenomena. So it comes, we need to understand in that way long description. Essential meaning is that. So I'll now go through reading. The body is neither feet nor clothes. Our concept of body, we need to see that. When we think, naturally think, oh, my body, that concept of body, we have that concept of body. Now he's talking about that object of our concept of body. We conceive naturally, ignorantly, conceive the body as a whole, or body as a one, or body as a one from body as a separate, or one, or from the parts of the, from the branches of all our body. So now he's giving the ultimate state of our body, which is the selflessness, identitylessness of the body. Our natural concept, ignorant concept, identify body as something, as a whole, or as a truly existent, or as a cleanliness, as a permanent yesterday body, today's body. Same, we conceived. So these are not the actual features, ultimate feature, or the actual features of the body. That's why our concept of body is wrong, as misapprehension of the body. Misapprehension of body. So in order to build the proper apprehension of the body, which is the understanding of the identitylessness of body, we need to and go through these all. The body is neither the feet nor calves, thighs and waist are not the body. The abdomen and back are not the body. Neither are the chest and shoulders the body. The ribs and the hands are not the body. Armpits and nape of the neck are not the body. All inner organs are not the body. Neither the head or neck are the body. Therefore, what truly exists in body is there among these parts. Naturally, when we see with our unexamining mind, the deluded mind, unexamining mental state, or the deluded mental state, when we think of body, then our concept of body is wrong, or is a concept our concept of body is wrong, which do not accord the reality of the body. Do not accord the reality of the body. And because of misconceiving the body, then the other emotions, disturbing emotions, and it generates from that concept. And then the actions, wholesome, unwholesome actions, the stained, sort of polluted wholesome actions also sort of arises from those disturbing emotions. And by that process, and we fall in the cyclic existence and never sort of never be able to get freedom from the cyclic existence, whether in on behalf of oneself or on behalf of the other sentient beings. If the body abided in all its limbs equally in all directions, indeed I could say that all the parts of the body abide in parts of its limbs. But where could the particles truly exist in body itself abide? It would have to exist independent of its parts and unrelated to them. And if the entire truly existent body abided separately in each of the individual parts, such as the hands, then there would have to be as many bodies as there were parts. If there is no truly existent body outside or within, if there is no sort of body, not only the truly existent, if there is no body outside or within, how could the hands and so forth have such a body at all? Such a body. Also, since it is not something different from the hands and other parts, how could a separate body unrelated to its parts exist? Therefore, body is not truly existent, but through being confused about its hands and other parts, through sort of seeing all the branches of, especially all the outer and the branches or outer parts of our body, a mind that conceived them as a body arises through seeing, because of a strong habituation. Because of a strong habituation from the beginningless time, then it's truly body arises. Even the illiterated person, they know, they also have the same concept. They conceive seeing their own parts of the body and then conceiving them as a one body, conceiving them as a one truly existent body. However, the body does not truly exist in the way it is apprehended by our normal sort of deluded mind, normal unexamining mental state, conventional mental state. It is like the mind apprehending a pile of stones. Thoyur, what do you call for that? Not pile of stone only, you feel in the field people put during the autumn in order to drive away the birds. They put some kind of
scarecrow.
I think not a pile of stone. This will be a scarecrow. It is like the mind apprehending scarecrows as a man because of their being set up in the form similar to a man. In the same way that the scarecrow will appear to be a man for as long as the causal condition to misconceive them as a man are assembled, as long as there's a total sort of any form of total similar form of the man in the shape of the man, so will the hands and so forth appear as a body for as long as the causal condition to conceive them, misconceive them as a body are present. Just as the body as a whole is not truly existent, how can the hands be truly existent? Now coming, first disproving the body as truly existent, separate sort of existence, separate truly existent from the parts of the body. Now, more refining of that understanding. Just as the body as a whole is not truly, how can the hands be truly? They are only a composite of finger. Fingers too are not truly, because they are a collection of joints, and the joints in turn, by being divided into their parts, are also found to be not truly existent, found to be non-existence at the ultimate level, found to be not truly existent. This is a little bit difficult. Likewise, then these parts are divided into atomic particles and atomic particles into their directional parts. Somewhere, for example, these small particle, then it also has a directions. This side, that side, that side, that side, upper and lower, and four intermediated directions. This is a very subtle analysis done by the Chittamatra school, in which the Madhyamika also sort of agree with that. So Madhyamika did not disapprove the Vyabhasaka and Swatantrika's assertion of truly existence of the indivisible and the indivisible atoms, separately, because because the Madhyamika school and consider the Chittamatran's analysis this indivisible touching from the 10 directions, then they disapprove the truly existence of the indivisible particles. No, when we look very deep inside, we don't look very deeply, huh? The shape of the nose or shape of the cheeks or whatever, and look very deeply, then we'll find the true nature of them, true reality of them. Likewise, then these parts are divided into directional parts. They are revealed as multiples and thus cannot be truly units. Even when the directional parts are divided up, they are found to be devoid of truly existent part. Hence, they are found to be as empty as space, and so even empty as space. That means that from the viewpoint of that analytical mental state, the form cannot be found. Body or their parts or the very sort of the very root source of all the gross, all the gross kasure, gross parts of the body, not only the body itself, but also the other body, the indivisible atoms, that also cannot be found. That also cannot be found from that analysis. So it is like a space. It means here the space. Sometimes, not only in the present paramita, but also in accordance with the Tantrayana, it is referred to the analogy of the space, through the analogy of space. That means that not the truly existent of the phenomena, but also the phenomena themselves do not exist ultimately, means from the viewpoint of ultimate analysis, or from the viewpoint of the transcendental wisdom, the direct realization of the emptiness. Thus, although the body appears to be truly existent to the unexamining mind, unexamining our mental, conventional mental state, in fact, it is not. Therefore, those who, having analyzed it, would be attached. Therefore, those who possess the kinds of analysis towards body, this kinds of analysis towards body, would be attached to this dream-like form. And when in this way the body is not unfounded, from the viewpoint of this kind of analysis, when the body is unfounded, how can the distinction be made into male and female bodies? From the perspective of that analytical mind, there's also not a difference between male and female body, because there's no any appearance of male and female body, no some kind of image, male and female body, not to the eyes, but to that, while seeing the female and body, male body by the eyes and with the understanding of the ultimate reality of the body, then that understanding does not and you conceive the other as a male body, one as a male body and another as a female body. When he has no such distinction, such kind of concepts of male and female, then the desirous attachment towards the male or female body cannot arise in him. And by that way, he does not commit actions related with the related or action invoked by the desirous attachment. And then from that on, he can... Now, close placement of mindful of feelings. Oh. Okay. With this merit, may I attain omniscience and defeat the force of mental affliction. May all sentient beings be liberated from the ocean of samsara, which is disturbed by the strong waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Just as Manjukosha knows all, so as Samudrabhadra does, may I follow all of them and dedicate all the merits. I think Rinjala will announce, huh? My class at 11 o'clock, as well as the revision class. Thank you.